Well, we have a little bit of bonus content for you folks, and this was spurred by a comment that we got on the SoundCloud feed. That's right, we do have a SoundCloud feed for the adaptation episode. You'll recall that on that episode, we had one of our trademark discussions about art. I was memorializing my hero, my role model, the great and completely acquitted sculptor, Carl Andre, famous for his bricks and hay bales and such. And Luke was not really having that. And we had, there's a comment on the SoundCloud that Luke and I got to talking about, and we felt that it might be fun to just kind of hash it over because, well, folks, I'll tell you. So the comment by one Griffineer, who maybe he's one of you. If you're Griffineer, don't worry, this is a safe space. Despite the rather hostile tone of your comment, this is a safe space.
Yeah, we don't wrestle with chimney sweeps. We keep everything, you know, on a high level.
Griffineer says, I love it when an upper middle class man who doesn't have a real job, that's you, Luke, uses a child's version of vulgar Marxism to argue the same points people like Steven Crowder and company argue. Postmodern art is worthless garbage because, neoliberalism, commodity fetishism, whatever buzzword makes you happy, please.
Where did you get that recording of me that you just played?
Griffineer continues, please tell me, when Marcel Duchamp made Fountain in 1917, was neoliberalism invented yet? No, of course it wasn't. F, sit down. So for a little context, if people don't know, Fountain was the famous sculpture, really a found sculpture that Marcel Duchamp made of a urinal that he signed his name on. It was and remains a huge provocation of like, what is art? Can anything be art? If I say it's art, is it art? If I put this in a gallery, is it art? You will still see trad Twitter accounts posting the photo of the Duchamp urinal and saying, ha, look at this degenerate society that calls this art when actually art is, and then they'll post a picture of, I don't know, a Roman statue or something like that. So Luke, upper middle class man, doesn't have a real job, vulgar Marxist, j'accuse. I mean, as we were talking about this when the mics were off, you were mentioning to me, and I think it's an interesting point, and I want to explore it a little bit, the difficulty of making sort of a left-wing cultural critique that doesn't sound scoldy and lame. Is that fair to say? Is that an area of anxiety?
Well, definitely. And I think it's a problem, honestly, with a lot of like left-wing cultural commentary or cultural commentary that's trying to be left-wing. I mean, think about like how many like irritating podcasts there are where it's just people, you know, we make fun of them all the time as one of, you know,
the only good left-wing
you know, culture and politics podcast. Yeah, where I don't know, there is like a whole genre, right? Where it's, you know, you watch something and you're like, yeah.
Is Batman sufficiently anti-fascist?
That's right. And then if it's not, you say, well, there's end of discussion. There's nothing else to talk about here. Films are good or bad, or, you know, culture is good or bad based on, yeah, how much it like lines up with a particular set of pre-existing ideological criteria. So yeah, that whole mode, for reasons that I don't need to elaborate on, obviously lends itself to a type of like curmudgeonliness that, yeah, definitely in its curmudgeonliness can echo, yeah, like right-wing cultural commentary of a kind where it's just, yeah, complaining about how everything's trash. Everything used to be good. I mean, I love that genre of right-wing tweet where it's, you know, four images that are all from capitalist societies. But yeah, and, you know, there's one that's supposed to represent traditionalism. And it's like the facade of some grotesque 19th century castle built by someone who got wealthy from the slave trade. And then they're just weepily posting like, we used to be governed by virtue. So yeah, I'm very cognizant of that. And I guess just before I go on, I mean, I will say like to the person who posted that, you know, I'm sorry if I offended you. I mean, it's, you know, I would guess that
our philosophy on this podcast is let people enjoy things.
And I enjoy Marcel Duchamp. In fact, that period, I mean, Dadaism and Cubism, I mean, that post-World War I art is some of my favorite art to exist.
Well, you and I agree on that.
I fucking love it. I love that period. There's so many interesting German artists, French artists, especially. Oh,
yeah. Give me some Otto Dix, you know? Give me a little Francis Bacon, you know?
I was just going to bring up Otto Dix. Love it. And also, even if I didn't love it, you know, who cares? I'm a guy on a podcast. Enjoy whatever you want to enjoy. That's fine. But even though posted with a little bit of hostility, I mean, I would thank the person who posted this, because I do think it's a useful way of sort of getting at something Will and I return to periodically in the eternal dialectic of this show, the different things that he and I appreciate, and perhaps the different, I don't know, sensibilities of art, philosophies of art that map onto them. I don't think it's fair to say that the critique that I was advancing on our recent episode is like the same as Steven Crowder's or something like that. First of all, those guys, what they do and say is completely incoherent, because they're like, oh yeah, like the 21st century, it's like so debased. And then they just all like relish like the most debased parts of it, right? It's like the denizens of the so-called trad alt-right are also the people who are like whacking off on 4chan to tentacle porn. And I mean, who are like thoroughly like the products of like postmodernism and posting culture in every way. They're the products of the very thing that they're deploring. Like the entire pathology of the modern right is to zealously embrace the market and then just constantly whine about what happens when you end up living in the market society that you set out to create and successfully did. So that is not, I stress, my own point of view about these things. My project, insofar as I have one when it comes to you know, this particular debate about art and culture, is not to preserve some kind of idea of tradition or the traditional as sacrosanct. I mean, as I just said, probably my favorite period of art is the stuff that emerges after the First World War, which is all very impressionistic, very abstract. It's people who are trying to work through the trauma of the First World War. I mean, Otto Dix in the literal sense, you know, these paintings of the trenches. But, you know, it's people who are breaking form, who are deconstructing the whole idea of form, and got absolutely incredible results doing that. I'm not interested in preserving, and I mean, this is a point on which I think Will and I very strongly agree, some kind of distinction between, you know, the high and low or something like that. Because I think people rightly regard that as an elitist point of view. And in an essay of Will's, that's one of my absolute favorite pieces of Will Sloan writing. I've plugged it on the podcast many times. I'm going to do so again. Will wrote a great essay for Hazlitt about Roger Ebert's zero-star reviews, the thesis of which was Ebert is a very intelligent, liberal guy who appreciates cinema very deeply, and that is his gift. But that ideological perspective also limits him. And look at, you know, the radical queerness he missed in the films of John Waters, for example. He is ultimately shackled by, yeah, trying to hang on to some idea of, you know, a distinction between the high and low that is ultimately not really a defensible one. And so I'm not out to kind of attack, you know, what Frederick Jameson might call aesthetic populism as such. I'm not trying to defend a tradition as such either. The idea of art that I think I want to preserve, and the one that I think I'm most strongly able to identify with, I think really has its origins in the 19th century. It's a modernist idea. It has roots in romanticism. It comes out of what Charles Taylor once called the ethic of authenticity. This is generalizing a lot, obviously, but I mean, there was a conception of art for, you know, centuries, to be conservative about it, I mean, over a millennia, certainly, if not longer, that really was just, it wasn't about high and low, it was just the high, right? It was wealthy people going to artists who were kind of like merchants or actually in some societies, kind of almost like craftsmen, and saying, hey, will you make like a marble bust of me? Will you do a big, tall, like painting that will fit the cathedral high ceilings of my castle or palace or country estate? That's kind of what a lot of, you know, paintings, especially in sculpture, that's like the family that those things belong to. And increasingly after the Enlightenment, and especially, you know, Fine's very strong expression really comes to fruition most strong, I think, in the 19th century, there's a kind of radicalized idea of art in which, you know, it represents the inner being of the person who's created it. So it kind of comes from within. It's very attached to our modern ideas of the self and of the individual, and that people have qualities that are innate to them and unique to them, which is also where we kind of draw the modern idea of human rights and is a very important antecedent to socialism as well. And for me, that idea, which I think should be or will probably be pretty non-controversial to a lot of you listening, right? Art is individual expression, right? It's kind of axiomatic when we think about what art is. But for me, we run into a problem with the kind of post-Warhol generation of artists. This is a massive generalization. I'm not trying to sort of indict everything that's come after Andy Warhol. I was talking on our episode recently about, you know, expressionist artists I like and, you know, various kinds of postmodern art that I like. So that is not the issue here for me. If there is a distinction that I'm interested in preserving and that I think is important to preserve, or at least to kind of defend and invoke as an important one to keep in mind, it's not the distinction between high and low. It's the distinction between art and commodity. And obviously, you know, Will has said many interesting things over the years on this show that, you know, I think kind of problematize the border between those two things, challenge it. And I will readily concede that it is sometimes difficult to make a distinction between those two things, or if not a distinction, it can be difficult to figure out where one stops and the other begins in certain cases. But my reason for kind of identifying this border and often kind of structuring my feelings about art and culture around it is that I think many of the, you know, malaises and the, if you want, spiritual crises, I'm not sure how else to describe them, of 21st century modernity really come down to the fact that we are a hyper-commodified society in which the border between, I mean, forget art and commodity, the border between being a fucking human being and commodity has collapsed.
Boy, don't I know it, brother.
You know, commodity is absolutely everywhere. You know, the commodification process, and it really is a process. You can have a capitalist society in which commodification, I mean, there are gradations of capitalism, like in the same way that there were gradations of feudalism that existed as it was being replaced by capitalism. Capitalism is not a zero-sum thing, and commodification is not a zero-sum process. For me, there is something fundamentally alien to, you know, for want of a better way of describing it, the human condition, human nature, about a society whose core logic, even kind of the core logic that often structures or dictates interpersonal relations, you know, that dictates how we, as just regular people going about our lives, like communicate our lives to the rest of the world. There is something fundamentally alien to who we are and to what being human is if the core logic behind all of that is just one of buying and selling. Neoliberalism is distinct from earlier forms of capitalism, earlier incarnations of it, precisely because it advances the idea, which, you know, and here it's drawing from like the liberal capitalist theory that begins in the 17th century. Neoliberalism reconceives the self. It reconceives the individual. All of us are little firms. We're little self-maximizing economic agents. We are quite literally walking brands. You know, what was it that Margaret Thatcher said, right? Economics are the method. The object is to change the soul. And neoliberalism has changed the soul, or at least it's tried to. It has reinvented, or at least significantly shifted, what it means to be a human being. And it has done that precisely by advancing the idea that there's no distinction to be made between the self and the world of buying and selling. We are all quite literally commodities and, you know, like little firms who ultimately just want to become bigger firms. You know, we don't want to think of ourselves as commodities, of course. We want to become rich people. We want to become become owners. We want to become managers. But at the end of the day, all of us are just little firms. That is the conception of the self that neoliberalism advances. And so when it comes to culture, I think there is an important boundary to be drawn here, because I want to preserve the idea that it's possible for people to express themselves in a way that isn't just concerned with buying and selling. So that is the root of the thinking that I've advanced in previous discussions on the podcast, most recently in our conversation about the film Adaptation. And again, my priority is not to kind of defend some idea of like a halcyon traditional past that's primordial and that's been, you know, mangled or disfigured by democratic modernity or something like that. It's quite the opposite. I want to defend an idea of art that I really think comes out of the 19th century and is something that very much challenges notions of the traditional, certainly notions of the traditional and notions of art that structure themselves around an idea of high and low.
I don't hear anything in there for me to disagree with. Is it possible that you're constructing a straw man? Because there are a lot of artists that, you know, you or I may not like, who may be selling for a lot of money on the auction block, who could say, you know, I'm following my muse and the market happens to have looked kindly upon it. I don't know where this fits in. It's not a rebuttal. I think it's maybe a version of what you're saying, but from a slightly different angle. One of the, you know, many minor controversies that I followed in the months since October 7th was in Art Forum magazine, you know, the editor of that magazine, you know, the Bible or the former Bible of the American art industry, was hastily fired when he published an open letter signed by a number of artists in support of a ceasefire. And a number of those artists, not most, not even a huge minority, but some, took their names off the petition when they were pressured by certain of their dealers. Their dealers saying to them, "We will make the value of your art plummet. We know how to do that if you don't take your name off this petition." That's a pretty scary thing. You know, theoretically, an artist is supposed to stand up against that kind of thing. So that's something that scares me about the current context. But I believe the artist that sparked this debate was the great and morally virtuous Carl Andre. It's true that, you know, his wealth and status protected him against some pretty heinous charges. And, you know, it's true that his work sold all over the world. But at the end of the day, like, at the time that he was operating, he did something original. He did something very unique. And it caught on, not just because a conspiracy of art dealers said it would catch on, but because nobody had ever seen anything like it. You know, it's the same thing with Andy Warhol. When he painted a soup can and he painted it in that way, the provocation of doing that was very powerful. And in fact, I think certain of his early stuff has aged better than Andre's because it wasn't pure provocation. There was some odd aesthetic beauty to what he did. By the way, I don't find all of Warhol's work equally compelling. The sort of celebrity portraits that he was doing in the 80s, like he truly turned himself into a commodity. But, you know, that stuff I don't think has really stood the test of time the way that those early soup can things did. So I guess to what you were saying, my only question would be, what artists? In addition to, you know, what you said about the fact that the boundary between art and commodity has always been porous and difficult to navigate, although I would agree with you, the modern context is different than the 19th century context when it's more hyper-localized and it's a rich person going to a tradesman in town saying, paint my daughter. You know, that's different than an art dealer calling somebody who signed a petition and saying, "We will make your work worth several thousand dollars fewer." Now I'm going to construct the straw man of my own. A kind of art that I don't like when I, a kind of modern contemporary art that I don't like when I go into a gallery. I'm sure that we've all seen a certain kind of art where it'll be a big photo of like somebody standing on some land and they're wearing a shirt that says 500 years ago, this land was colonized. On first glance, I look at that and I say, oh, well, you know, that seems like it's very trendy at the moment. You know, anti-colonial politics are all the rage and this is as didactic as possible. But I don't know, I say that and, you know, I'm constructing a straw man and, you know, maybe even that person would say, I'm just following my muse and I can't help it that it happens to align with the zeitgeist right now. I don't know. The boundaries of art and commerce are very difficult, very difficult.
Well, so just by way of a reply from my end, I mean, let's take the two kinds of examples that you offered. One is, these zeitgeisty kind of creator types who are just following their muse, as you put it. And the other was, you know, Andy Warhol and this, very virtuous sculptor who died recently.
And is in hell right now being tortured.
But I mean, I would say that, you know, the whole idea of like following your muse, right, which I think you used that phrase specifically because I've been advancing this idea of art as individual expression, right? Mm-hmm. So you're kind of challenging me by saying, okay, well, you might not like such and such a thing, but if somebody's, you know, if someone's individual expression, you know, it's kind of immaterial that they got rich off of it or that it, you know, caught the zeitgeist in some way and others made money off of it, which happens as well. What I would say to that is I do think there's a pretty meaningful distinction. I mean, obviously the following your muse thing is a straw man, right? So I'm going to lean on that a little bit here. You know, for me, like the criterion I would use to evaluate that is, did whatever idea motivated the creation, whatever in whatever, you know, form it takes, was that idea rooted like in the person that created it? Or, and this is like obviously true in many instances because like we are all embedded in a market society, it's hyper commodified. Like, did somebody just create something because they saw a market niche and then created something? And it's like, it might be their individual expression. They might be following their muse in some kind of sense. But to me, that it's not really compatible with the idea of art that I'm advancing because it's ultimately rooted in commerce. Like if that's the point of origin, to me, the kind of ethos or aura of authenticity that's being grafted onto it. That's just like, that's just another selling point, right?
Well, did we see a market niche when we started this podcast, when we said maybe the time is right for Michael Moore nostalgia? don't we always, when we create something, say, why doesn't this exist in the world? I should be the one who creates it. And hey, if the spoils come my way.
Well, perhaps I'm not explaining myself very well here, because I'm saying that, like, your second type of example, which was Warhol and the sculptor, like, I guess you can evaluate the pieces on individual terms and decide whether you think they're quote unquote good or not. But I don't have as much trouble describing those as art, because as you've argued, like, they were kind of genuinely novel in some way, and they don't seem to have originated in people making a series of, you know, calculations with a proverbial abacus. Think about so many of the films we talk about on this podcast, where it really seems like they're, you know, designed by committee, and increasingly they're designed by a committee of robots. Their point of origin is quite literally commercial considerations. And this is particularly true of, like, many higher budget films these days, right? It's literally a series of calculations made on a spreadsheet about what's going to sell. And everything in the narrative, everything you see on the screen, you know, for merchandising purposes, you know, or whatever, for tie-ins with a video game, for cross-platform promotion, whatever it is, for gamification, that's all sort of worked out in advance. And the entire creative process, such as it is structured around that. And I don't know, to me, that's not art. That's just commerce.
Well, no disagreement from me if we're talking about The Flash. And I do think we need to protect art from that, whatever process created that movie.
If we think about social media today, you know, specifically, which, you know, it is supposed to be, right, like the method of individual expression. You can communicate your whole life. You can communicate your, you know, daily moments. Right? On Instagram, it's called a story. You know, you can literally just curate your life and, you know, present it. It is, on the face of it, you know, this singular method of individual expression. And, you know, this is complicated. I mean, social media has been a great way for lots of artists to promote their work, lots of writers. I genuinely think it is, in its, you know, not uncomplicated way, given the business models of social media companies. Like, I genuinely think it is, or it can be, you know, a means of individual or personal expression. But think about how much of, like, the worst stuff you see on social media is the product of people trying to sense out a niche, either for, like a literal market niche because they're literally trying to make money, or just something where it's like, oh, there's a hole in the discourse, and I'm not going to think through whether the argument or take that I'm inserting into that hole is rational. All I'm thinking about is the fact that there's a potential market here, and I kind of have a viral take that maybe, like, in 2 months I'll completely dispense with, I'll advance a completely alternative perspective when circumstances change and the tides have shifted. You know, and, like, that ethos does ultimately, like, come back to a kind of neoliberal ethic of self-maximization, where it's like, who cares if it's not coherent? Who cares if it, you know, originated in like a series of kind of crass calculations? And of course, like, doing that as the author of it, I'm not thinking about it in those terms. I spend all day online. I'm a poster. This is just me telling my truth. But at the end of the day, and I realize, you know, again, this is, you know, call this a straw man if you want, but that mindset all comes down to kind of self-maximization and the idea that we are firms and we are trying to, you know, expand the size of our firms and take over other firms and, you know, advance ourselves as brands. And that is not the same thing as individual expression. There endeth the lesson.